Hello and welcome back to the NovPod, your beginner's guide to obstetric anaesthetics. I'm Owen Dorr, I'm one of your co-hosts, and this podcast mini-series has been launched in association with the Royal College of Anaesthetists and the Obstetric Anaesthetists Association. Today, we are talking about pain during cesarean section, and we are joined by a prominent patient advocate, Susanna Stanford, to talk about her experiences and what we as a specialty can learn from an adequate block during cesarean section. For me, this conversation was practice changing. It does involve discussions of birth trauma and PTSD, so if you're not feeling in the correct headspace, maybe listen to it another time or with a colleague. So welcome back to the NovPod. This is episode 11, which is about how we can become the patient's advocates and guardians of psychological safety in the operating theatre. So the title of this episode is Preventing and Managing Pain During Cesarean Section. My name is Owen Dorr. I'm one of the co-hosts. I'm a anaesthetic registrar in Thames Valley, and I'm joined by...
Hello, I'm Rosie. I'm another one of the anaesthetic registrars working in South East London with an interest in obstetric anaesthesia and specifically about this topic that we're doing today. So we've got Susanna Stanford with us.
So Susanna is a fantastic guest to have on today. She is probably one of the foremost patient advocates in the UK, and since an experience that we'll get onto in 2010, has really championed listening to women during cesarean sections in regards to intraoperative pain. She gave a keynote address in 2015 that by all accounts was very moving. By 2017 she joined the executive committee of the OAA and was there for 6 years, and she was involved in the recent guidelines that have been released in 2022 about pain during cesarean section. Welcome, Susanna.
Thank you very much for inviting me.
And thank you for coming down today. And I'm really looking forward to the conversation. Well, we're really looking forward to the conversation. There's no I in team, is there? There's no I in NovPod either.
No.
Really looking forward to this conversation today, where we will talk a bit about your experience, talk a bit about what the term failure actually means in the context of obstetrics. Then we'll get on to testing, how we can adapt to problems, communicate well with our patients and birthing partners, think about our human factors, and then we'll go through our lesson learned again, followed by a fantastic message to the obstetric novice. But we're very excited for this episode.
So, Susanna, thank you so much for coming down to speak to us today. I think this is an episode that we've all been really excited about, and we've also been really grateful for your input in providing lots of the references, which will all be linked underneath the episode. There's loads of amazing guidelines there. There's editorials. I would really encourage everyone listening to have a look. There's lots more information there, and they're amazing, amazing references that you've been directly involved in making. And I wondered if you could just, for our listeners, elaborate a little bit about your experience and how that's led to you being here today with us.
Thank you very much. Well, it's very important to state right at the beginning that I never thought harm was intended at the time of my C-section in 2010. And believing that, I wanted to understand what had gone wrong and what could be learned from it. So we'll start by just rewinding a little bit and give you a bit of insight into what had happened. I have two sons. First was born naturally. It was very straightforward. After 24 hours, I had an epidural, which was marvellous. Worked a treat. Amazing. Then second time round, 2010, I had a low-lying placenta. And as it was an anterior placenta previa, it was made very clear to me that this would be a higher risk delivery. It was life-saving surgery. But because the spinal failed, I was able to feel major abdominal surgery. And that was every bit as horrific as you might imagine. Mm-hmm. Now, really, everything should have been fine. A consultant set up the spinal. He was very confident that the block would be good. However, while the anaesthetic worked on my motor nerves, the effect was patchy with my sensory nerves. During testing, I struggled with one particular question, and unfortunately, the anaesthetist persisted in repeating that question multiple times. I held my own for quite a long time, but felt under enormous pressure to give the go-ahead. There was a room full of people waiting. I was aware of the expectation that the block should be working. I was lying on my back, looking up into the face of someone who was convinced that the block would be working. He was the expert and the person with authority. And that's a really difficult situation in which to go against authority. So despite real reservations, because I was not sure, I decided that a slight difference in sensation that I could feel must be sufficient. And I gave the go-ahead. I knew I had given the wrong answer when I felt the first incision, literally like a beanbag being unzipped. However, the anaesthetist was so certain that the block would be working that he was slow to recognise that it wasn't. The operation was stopped on three occasions. Initially, I was offered Enzanox for what was referred to as my anxiety, and I remember being outraged by that. I then got two doses of amphetamine, and I will say that that did not touch the sides of the plane because it was really severe. And eventually, I was given a general anaesthetic. It was immensely traumatic because as a mother, my fear was focused on the safety of my child whilst enduring indescribable pain, pain that I perceived as life-threatening. The experience was then compounded afterwards when things were not handled well by the anaesthetist and the hospital trust. When I was discharged, my GP received only the most basic discharge information, which gave detail of a routine C-section under regional anaesthetic. So there was no support, and unsurprisingly, I developed post-traumatic stress. I only went back to my GP 10 months later, and that was the first time she learned I'd had the general. She wrote to the hospital requesting an opportunity to go through my notes and received a letter back which stated that I had been conscious and comfortable at the time of delivery. And obviously, had I been comfortable, there would have been no need for the general. So there was no technical error. It came down to a failure to be prepared for failure, a failure of non-technical skills, and everything was compounded afterwards by the failure to respond appropriately.
I think the word that you've just mentioned there leads on really well to our next section, which can be opened up really with what is failure, because there are different definitions that are around.
What I would say, an inadequate block is a euphemism for failure. Failure is the patient's experience of any inadequate anaesthesia. Full stop. Yes, you're absolutely right. We've had different definitions of failure, one of them being the conversion to general anaesthesia. But that is to take a single clinician-determined intervention as your basis for recording failure, as opposed to the patient experience. Estimates do vary. In 2022, a systematic review published in Anaesthesia, which looked at 3,497 patients across 54 studies all over the world. And they found that for elective cases, 14.6% required additional anaesthesia or analgesia. The authors presumably thought that sounded like a lot. Then they reassured themselves that actually, well, of those, only two had been converted to a general anaesthetic. And so therefore, well, if you took general as severe failure, then it was very few. And we don't actually know whether the other 508 had received adequate anaesthesia for their pain. So there's a real question around the patient experience. And the point is that if you look at definitions of pain, they all come down to it is something in the experience of the patient. Mm-hmm. We're only now beginning to get research looking at patient-reported outcomes. But remembering that complaints will always be the tip of the iceberg, of course. But in 2009, Anaesthesia published an analysis of litigation relating to inadequate anaesthesia. The severity of reported harm after awareness under regional anaesthesia was equivalent to that after awareness under general anaesthesia. Now, AAGA has rightly had a lot of attention. But the authors commented that as regional anaesthesia was considerably less frequent than general anaesthesia, a similar prevalence of litigation indicated a notably higher incidence of cases due to regional failure. 83% were in an obstetric setting, and most were due to surgery starting with an inadequate block. Now, the reason I mention this is that the finding from the litigation analysis emphasizes that just because the patient is having a baby and birth is generally acknowledged to be painful, that does not mean that intraoperative pain during a cesarean is equivalent to labor pain. The two are distinctly different, taken from me. I've experienced both. Pain during cesarean is not something we should be expecting women to withstand or to cope with. But not wanting to scare the living daylights out of everybody. All that said, anaesthetists do enjoy high levels of success with regional blocks. And when blocks work, they're like magic. You know, they're brilliant. So it's not all terrible.
You've raised a really interesting point there, which is that for somebody who's just had a baby, to go to the lengths to even have the time to be able to think about writing a complaint. So it's really, really important for us to think about those people who might not have the time, the energy, the resources to actually get to that stage.
And the resources are really important, right? Because access to making a complaint is not equitable. You've got to be in a position to do so. I mean, personally, I never made a complaint. I realised that I was potentially going to be in a very adversarial situation because it was my word against theirs. I had notes that said I had a routine C-section and that I'd been comfortable. So like, well, how do you come back from that? You know, it's actually really hard to get anywhere with that. But actually, you're absolutely right. Most people, they're trying to get on with looking after a baby, living their lives, holding down jobs, looking after other children. Don't forget that, you know, often it's not just going to be the first baby. All those things mean that complaining most of the time won't even happen.
Yeah.
Part of the reason for doing this podcast is to introduce that 15% of the time you will be having to think of other things. And if this is worrying you, then I think it should, because it is something you're going to be looking after at night, and being able to recognise it, know what guideline to look at, and call for help and communicate well is the whole aim for this episode. So I know you might be feeling worried at home. I really would point you to what Rosie has mentioned earlier and those guidelines that you were involved with, Susanna, and wrote. Go and have a look at them and a read through before you're on obstetric nights yourself.
I would also just pull up on one of the things that you've mentioned, Susanna. So the documentation that you had a comfortable cesarean section. Lots of what we are taught about when we're starting obstetric anaesthesia is the importance of documentation and how that will be possibly looked back on at a later date. And I would really encourage people when they're first starting out in obstetric anaesthesia to make sure that you are writing down your discussions with the people that you're looking after. So if a patient says to you that they are uncomfortable, find out what that sensation is and then write down their words in quotation marks and write what you're going to do about it, write what you did, and write if it worked. Because I think often it's just the case that nothing's written down and then somebody will come back and say, oh, well, from what we've got written, it was comfortable. And that's not necessarily a good reflection of the true experience.
And also the exact time that those conversations have happened, because just because you have offered a GA 5 minutes ago does not mean you can re-offer a GA in another 5 minutes. And having that exact time that someone has been in discomfort, pain, uncomfortable, you need to have made sure that time has shown how you're reacting and whether or not these interventions are working, as you mentioned. Today, we are using the word neuraxial anaesthesia a lot, and this can mean spinals, single shot, or it could mean epidural top-ups, and some centres that will be a combined spinal epidural. To make sure that we are happy, would be doing something called testing of the block. Rosie, what do we mean by testing?
The main thing that I would say on this point is have a look at the testing guidelines that are linked in the episode. It will be very boring if I regurgitate them, but essentially you are checking that the intervention that you have done, i.e. put your spinal in, done your epidural top-up, done your CSE, is having the response that you expect and that the patient has an adequate motor and sensory block for the surgery that is about to occur.
Fantastic. Thank you for that. And I know that you've got a really good line about testing, Susanna, so I won't steal it from you, but what are your reflections on testing from a patient advocacy point of view? Why do we test?
First point is to say that the point with testing is that unlike complications which happen with little warning, block failure is something that very often can be controlled for in advance by testing the block well. My first point is to say, well, you've got to remember why you test something. If you could safely assume every time you place a block, it's working, you wouldn't be testing. You test because you cannot afford to make an assumption. Now, when you're placing the block, especially if this is a new skill, you need to be able to visualize doing it right. You know, everything we do on motor skills, like, you know, wanting to play a sport, if you drive a car, you know, you're visualizing doing something correctly. This is no different. But when you move to testing, you have to change gear. You've got to change mindset. So you're going from the confidence of, I will do this, to being able to question. There's a really natural tendency to personalize things and to think of it as my block, that it's the, you know, your block. It's really, really helpful to remember that this is not personal. You've got your block in, you put it in the right place. You're testing the block, not your block. This shift can help take the pressure off you a little bit. My next thing would be to say, well, you know, don't rush it. You know, actually, it's going to take a little while for the block to take effect. So don't go straight in and start testing straight away. It's much more reassuring for you and the patient if things are beginning to be working when you start testing. It also really helps most people, I believe, to have a rhythm of testing at particular time points, because that helps you develop a feel for how they spread. And then if you've got one that's not spreading as you would expect, then you're immediately going to be much more alert to it. Next, be aware of human factors. In this situation, we're talking about the cognitive biases, which can entirely subconsciously influence decision-making and lull people into making mistakes. The three most likely in my case were confirmation bias, fixation error, and continuation bias. So I'll just run through and explain those a little bit to introduce them as ideas. On confirmation bias, it is natural to subconsciously look for things that it confirm what you're expecting to see. Most of the time, your block's going to be working, so it's really easy to get into a pattern of looking for the things that you're expecting to see. And you're expecting it to work, so you're looking and you're assuming that it's going to. You need to work with the assumption that the block is not working until you can prove that it is. Now, interestingly, my understanding from patients who've experienced both good and bad blocks is that they found testing really easy with a good block. So if you've got a patient who is unsure, that may be a warning of a suboptimal block. On fixation error, I would hope that everyone knows Elaine Bromley's case. If you haven't heard of this, look up on YouTube, just a routine operation. It is absolutely vital learning for everybody. Continuation bias comes from a really natural hope that everything's going to be okay if you stick to your original plan. But with spinal blocks, there's absolutely no point testing if you're not able to identify and respond to a poor block. And the important point with all of these potential errors is that they can be countered with active listening. Hearing what is said and how contributes to a clinician's situational awareness.
Something that you've said previously to myself and Duncan on Zoom is that the mother's primary concern is very, very, very likely the baby, and that they will want that baby to be born as soon as possible, and you are there as the patient's advocate to make sure that we aren't pressing ahead without you being happy with this block. Rosie and I, and I'm sure Susanna, would very much encourage, if you are unsure of your testing, phone the friends, call your reg, ask a consultant for advice, even if it's 2, 3am.
Yeah, don't just start and hope for the best and see what happens. That's not a foolproof course of action. Just to go through a whistle-stop tour of the guidelines in the context of what you actually might see in theatre being done. Hopefully when you're first starting out and you're getting to grips with things like spinals and epidural top-ups, you'll see how the different techniques will respond and you'll get a feel for what's normal and what's not normal and what people are expecting as they're testing them. But in general, you would start a timer when your neuraxial block is embarked upon. And then you would test at set time points the motor and sensory aspects of the block. And what the guidelines suggest for the motor testing is to ask the patient to do a straight leg raise. I think this is often a moment where people in the theatre breathe a sigh of relief when they are unable to. But again, be careful of that confirmation bias and make sure you're properly testing your sensory block as well. On the point of motor block, you might come across the Bromage score being in your documentation booklets or on your computers. It can be confusing sometimes because it can be the opposite way round on some resources. The most simple way of demonstrating a motor block is an inability to straight leg raise. So if that is what you write down, that's absolutely fine. There's no need to complicate things with 0, 1, 2, 3, etc.
Although individually in the units, they may wish you to do that. Check your local guidelines, but be aware that the national guidelines say SLR. Top tip, if you've got someone that's partially motor blocked, make sure when you're asking them to lift their leg, there is someone there to catch it or to stop it falling off the table, because there's no way to make yourself look less slick than watching a patient's leg fall off the table, which is not great.
Sounds like that comes from experience.
No, never. That's when you then have to instantly regain the trust of a patient.
In terms of sensory testing, I think the most common thing that we all see in theatres is actually loss of temperature sensation testing with ethyl chloride spray. Spraying on the patient's hand and saying, "This feels cold, right?" with that suggestion, and then spraying up the patient's legs and body to see if there's that change in sensation. Whilst this is widely done, it has been shown that actually light touch is a much more reliable test of the block. Ideally, you want a loss of light touch to T5 or higher, and that should be your main determination of whether or not the sensory block is working.
Having spoken about testing from the clinician's perspective, can we just quickly give your listeners a sense of what testing is like from the patient perspective?
Yes, please do.
We can train you beforehand so that you develop, and you will develop, experience. But remember that more often than not, your patient is coming in cold and they've got no training to deal with this situation at all. So they've got no prior experience. And antenatal education being what it is in this country, more often than not, they're completely unprepared for a C-section. And there are a number of factors which will influence them in the moment. Rosie, you've already mentioned that the focus will be on the safety of the baby. That instinct is strong. Mothers will allow harm to themselves for the sake of their babies. So it's a massive responsibility to make sure that you're taking good care of the mother. And actually, the anaesthetist is very often the only person in the room whose sole focus is on the mother. Second, from a patient perspective, well, you're not really yourself. You know, you go into the hospital, you put on an operating gown, and you cease to be you. We do acknowledge the hierarchical gradient in the operating theatre, but patients experience it too. They have to place extraordinary trust in the team. Let's face it, this is the only environment in which any of us would passively allow masked strangers to come at us with knives. But added to that, the patient is not equal in terms of skill and knowledge. And physically, they're in a deeply subservient position. Medics need to appreciate the extent to which their position, both metaphorically and physically, will influence the patient. And even patients who are clinicians comment on this. So for example, after an emergency C-section, one consultant obstetric anaesthetist wrote, "Your story helped me to stick to my guns about my own inadequate block, despite having great concerns for my own baby's welfare." Now, not unrelated, you have the issue of suggestion. Patients are suggestible, especially if they're highly anxious, distressed, or in pain. So you need to avoid what would, in a legal context, be called leading the witness. Be careful to ask open questions so you don't make them feel that they should be giving you the answer they think you want to hear. Finally, be aware that they're going to be experiencing the sense of time pressure, particularly obviously if this is an emergency, of course, but even if it's an elective, they'll sense the time passing and they'll be very aware that they've got lots of people waiting. So there's a lot going on. It's important to appreciate that this is why communication matters. It allows patients to orientate themselves in an unfamiliar situation. It helps them to feel safe, to feel more in control, and it enables them to speak up. And you really need them to be able to speak up.
On that, where we are empowering people to speak up. Let's just say we have got a situation where we know that 15% of our caesarean sections, despite the best intentions, will need adjuvants, or there will be some pain that's experienced. And again, there's very good advice from the 2022 guideline on the exact technical bits of what to do. But what we would like to do is just step on a minute of, let's say there is a problem that occurs under regional and the mother or patient is saying that they are in pain. How, from a patient perspective, would you want the anaesthetist to react?
Right, so you could have done everything right and still get a surprise. Also, be aware that the longer the surgery goes on, the more likely it is that you're going to have a block starting to wear off. So it could have started brilliantly, and then it becomes less so. The first point to make is that if a mother says she's in pain, believe her. She is the only one who knows. Without listening to your patient, you actually have no way of knowing how patchy the block, nor how extreme the pain. And I really can't emphasize this point enough. It's worth noting a study by Keltz and colleagues in the European Journal of Pain in 2021. They compared interoperative pain as perceived by clinicians with the interoperative pain reported by patients. And they found that anaesthetists and obstetricians underestimated maternal pain. Fascinating to note that there was actually a false positive rate of anaesthetist assessment of interoperative pain of 12.3%, but the false negative rate was 52.2%, which is huge. You'll be pleased to know that the anaesthetists did actually score better than the obstetricians.
Woohoo!
Yeah, you win some things. Another important point to make is that the study found that preoperative anxiety did not predict interoperative pain. So if you've got that situation and you've got a mother who is expressing distress, clearly, or saying that they are in pain, but they may be expressing distress without actively saying, I am in pain, you've got to make it clear that you're hearing what she's saying. Again, careful about the communication. Keep the questionnaire opening. Avoid putting words into her mouth. There are two particular phrases to avoid, which I've heard far too often, and both will have been intended as well-meaning reassurance, but they actually have the consequence of making someone feel that they're not being believed. The first of those phrases is, it's just pressure. Well, yes, sometimes people describe the sensation as like pressure, but if you have enough pressure, it's going to be painful. So don't just tell them that it's just pressure. And the second is, well, it's just anxiety. Obviously, I've already quoted the study finding that preoperative anxiety does not predict interoperative pain. But bear in mind, it's very hard to separate distress and anxiety from the experience of pain. The physical experience and the emotional response are connected. When you think about it, it would be pretty odd to not exhibit anxiety if you're in severe pain. So objectively, you may think your patient is physically safe. Fine. But believe me, if she's in pain having a C-section, she may not feel safe. And by extension, she may fear that her baby is not safe either. If an operation starts with an inadequate block, it is likely to become traumatic for the mother very quickly. From a personal perspective, the pain I experienced was perceived as life-threatening. Interestingly, when I wrote about my experience for IJOA 6 years later, I was still not able to articulate that. So I wrote, lying open on an operating table, I was not in the best position to make the best decision for myself. Well, it was true, and it was due to the stress response. We know that when the amygdala senses danger, the frontal cortex goes offline, impairing an individual's ability to think straight and to make decisions. Well, we always talk about the stress response in terms of fight and flight, but these are actually more typically the male response and they've had more attention. We actually have fight, flight, freeze, fawn. Awful lot of Fs. There's also flop if you really want to go for it. Mid C-section, a mother's focus will be on the safety of her baby. You're very vulnerable and you can't move. Fight and flight are not options. You only have freeze and fawn. And reflecting on my own experience, one of the most bizarre things afterwards was realizing that I had repeatedly apologized every time the operation was stopped. I was absurdly polite, and my brain's response had been to try and keep people on side. And I think this is why it's important, going right back to the beginning, thinking about consent. women need to be prepared for surgery under regional anaesthesia with appropriate information. As clinicians, you'll appreciate it's easier to manage stressful situations if you've known that a particular scenario will occur. But I've heard clinicians sometimes say that they don't like to mention interruptive pain because they don't want to make the patient worry. But then that patient could be blindsided. Yeah. It's much better for patients if before the operation, they've been told most blocks work very well, but if they're distressed from pain, you will be listening and you will work to make them comfortable.
And one of the links that we're providing in the bio that you've advocated for does mention that this needs to start and be instilled into novice training, correctly consenting people for this.
Absolutely. It's simply allowing your patient to be prepared. It's your opportunity to educate them, and unfortunately you have to assume that they've had no education on this before. Final point on consent, though, is to make it to be able to say that a general anaesthetic is a reasonable option. It's not like some scary last port of call that is terrifying for your patient. No, it is a reasonable option if needed. And the whole point of this is that you're telling them that there is a plan and you're making it really clear that you are on their side. Not condoning paternalism, absolutely not, but I do think it's right that the Montgomery ruling allows doctors to advise on the best course of action. So you can recommend a general. If you've got someone in pain before the baby's been delivered, well, it's very likely that it's going to get worse. But obviously, if the woman doesn't want one, of course you can't give it.
I think those are really, really useful insights from your perspective, and thank you for sharing it with us. One of the things that you touched on was the positioning, so the human factors around that conversation that's happening between you and this person in a perceived sense of authority because they've had the training and the education or whatever to become an anaesthetist. You're putting your trust in that person, so you want to keep them on side because they're part of the medical team looking after you and your baby, and that's your concern at that point. And I think it's really easy for us to forget sometimes, and this happens in lots of other areas as well, when you're just pre-assessing a patient on a ward who's in a bed and you're standing over them. And a really interesting thing to do is to sit down on the floor and get someone to talk to you from standing. And even if they're your best friend and they're saying nice things to you and they're smiling at you, it still feels really weird. And I know in obstetric theatre, there's so much going on. There's not very much space. You've got drapes up, you've got surgeons, you don't want to de-sterilise them. You've got a birthing partner there, you might have the midwife there as well. But what I have found quite useful previously when you're trying to have these conversations is instead of standing over, leaning over the woman and talking where you're upside down and looming over them, is to try and come around, even if that means walking around to the other side of the anaesthetic machine, you know, oh gosh, different position, trying to have that conversation so that you're at least sort of face to face and trying to get a little bit more down to their level if you can. I don't know, do you think that would be helpful?
It's really helpful. And actually, if you were to put yourself in the position of lying and having people stand in those two different positions, you would really feel the difference. You know, of course, it may not be possible to do that all the time, but even if you were to just come around for a bit of the time and just give the patient that opportunity to see you the right way up, and you know, and then you would be taking a bit of that pressure out. The whole point is that communication isn't just about words, right? Mm. Tone, posture, eye contact, those things all matter. And one final thing I would say is to say that patients are listening all the time.
Yeah.
So how you speak to each other can influence how safe we feel. So they're listening. They're
alert.
That's
interesting. Is that like a specific conversation that you heard or that other people have said?
It's been said to me a number of times.
What things have people overheard that panicked them?
It's not specific things, it's the tone of the conversation that's going on.
Okay, interesting.
And if people, you know, I mean, good teamwork, if you've got good civility in your team and people are talking to people each other in a cooperative manner, then they'll feel a lot safer.
Yeah,
they will pick up on terseness or rudeness or anything like that.
Yeah.
And they absolutely clock it. Just because they're not saying anything doesn't mean they're not there. The interesting thing about communication is that it is really quite hard to articulate what makes good communication, right? But I think most of us know it when we see it and hear it. Years later, I had the experience of sitting in the room while my son was having some metal work fixed in his mouth, and the dentist simply said, "I need you to tell me if it hurts because you're the only one who knows." And it's just so simple.
Yeah.
we keep coming to communication, but just for your listeners, just remember that for the patient, feeling heard and believed. So communication isn't just about you speaking, it's about you listening. For the patient, feeling heard and believed is an important mitigating factor in reducing the experience of trauma. So it's one of the things that you can do to reduce the experience of something becoming traumatic just because you're listening and responding.
I think you've touched really nicely on the kind of MDT communication there that we talk about a lot in the other episodes of this obstetric series as well. So obviously, if you're doing a neuraxial technique, you've got a finite set amount of time. So make sure you're communicating with your obstetricians. You're not starting a spinal if they're unavailable, for example, and just remembering all the time that you've got the rest of the labour ward there potentially, especially if you're on call, and you want to make sure that you're absolutely in tandem and in communication with the rest of your team so you can optimise your anaesthetic time for your wonderful block that you're going to do.
It's not your block, the block.
The block. The wonderful block that you're going to do. And I've Fantastic. Now got the wonderful Wizard of Oz in my head.
So there's two things I really like there. Firstly, is that we've used your versus my versus the. And secondly, that Rosie got it wrong. That was two brilliant things.
So mean. An important thing that I think you've mentioned about teamworking and seeking help, especially if you are in this position. We've talked about how, you know, if this occurs relatively early on, you are thinking about actually converting to a general anaesthetic. And I remember these feelings of kind of hesitancy about general anaesthetics and offering them, but kind of really deep down thinking, wow, this is stressful. Just feeling empowered to tell your team that this is what you're about to do, you know, phoning a friend, even if they can't directly come and help you, it's always better for people to know what's going on. Because then if an emergency call does go out for some reason, they know that you're delivering a general anaesthetic to somebody who already has potentially a partial regional block on board. In their head, their mental model might be already thinking, oh, okay, I need to try and stop what I'm doing so I can go and lend a hand upstairs, downstairs, etc. So just telling people what you're doing and seeking help if you need can be really, really valuable.
And being aware that the human factor side has a big role when you are performing a general anaesthetic, in that there are a lot of people around, there's a lot of talking, that you need to have your non-technical skills where you ask for quiet, where you are able to go forward with your plan and explain everything that you're doing to the patient, because it is a very frightening time to be put asleep after pain during cesarean section as well.
Yeah. I will say, though, if you've got severe pain, it's the most incredible relief to be freed of it. From the personal experience of having had that severe pain, as I went out, you know, I was being freed from that pain. You know, that was the most enormous relief to me. One tiny little detail of something that was done really well for me is that when I was about to have the general, the anaesthetist said to me, because my son was out by this point, said that my partner would hold my son. And that meant that I knew he was safe.
Yeah.
And that it's such a tiny detail. And obviously we've gone through all of this other stuff, so it's quite, you know, it's another thing to take on board. But actually that's a lovely touch to say, your partner's going to be holding your baby. Because that's part of their thing, is, you know, they're going out, they're going under, well, what's happening to their baby? Where is their baby? So actually, again, just remember their focus is on the baby.
Yeah.
In terms of communication, was there anything else that you wanted to say in terms of why it matters? We've covered if they feel believed and heard, it will reduce their trauma, which I think is an incredible point to make when we are opening up with the guardians of psychological safety in the operating theatre line as well.
I mean, all of these things, you know, your non-technical skills are what keep you and your patient safe. So it's really easy, and I completely understand, particularly if, you know, if you're starting in the new subspecialty, your focus will be on the technical skills. You've got to assimilate that technical skill and knowledge as fast as you can. And it's really natural to focus on that. I completely get it. But it's developing your non-technical skills, which is what's going to keep you safe, and also, of course, developing the knowledge of human factors as well, which goes far beyond just non-technical skills and communication. That's a much bigger field. The point is that what's really useful is that even if you don't end up in obstetric anaesthesia long term, those skills will be useful regardless of what you do, whether it's in anaesthesia or in medicine more widely. So these are skills that you will take with you beyond. So they're really valuable and they're worth being very conscious about trying to develop them, working out afterwards what went well, what could have been better, and just trying to be reflective about developing those skills.
You sit on a lot of human factors groups as well, don't you, Susanna?
Yeah. So, yeah, and I've been involved in various bits of research around maternity safety and the national standards for safety and invasive procedures. So I've seen this in lots of different contexts. And that ability to keep getting feedback is what develops people into the clinicians that they started out wanting to be. Everybody wants to be good at their job.
Agreed.
Right? You want to do the job well. So that requires that perpetual ability to keep seeking feedback. And it's not saying, what did I do wrong, which is very exposing and makes people feel very vulnerable. It's, well, what, is there anything I can do better? And just, again, open question. One thing I would say is that, you know, focus on getting your critique from people that you want advice from. You don't have to open yourself up to the most critical person, although actually, you know, sometimes you'll learn something from it. But you know who you would go to for advice. You know who your mentors are. Develop those relationships with people to be mentors and people that you can go to. Have those relationships in place, because actually that will really help you when something goes wrong. You actually want to have people that you know, whether they're peers, mentors, that you can go to and that you feel safe talking to. That's the most fundamental advice I could give to anybody, particularly earlier in their careers.
I really like that. Something will go wrong. This is medicine. This isn't binary numbers or dealing with different areas of tech. These are real people with real problems where you will be involved. And that's a difficult emotional burden to take on, but it's also very important that you understand how it went wrong and what you will do. And that's why we always talk about the Swiss cheese, because very rarely is it just one thing that one person has done at a set time point. There's always been areas that can lead to improvement. In terms of the novice anaesthetist as well, being aware of that and being aware that you will need to seek for advice and safety and have a low threshold to do for things. In your work with human factors and with the maternal safety, is there evidence for the teams with good communicational skills, with flat hierarchies, do better?
Oh yeah, absolutely. The difficulty for trainees or for SES doctors as well, their difficulty is that the culture is very often set by the people at the top. Mm. And that makes it really difficult. That said, the more that you are able to work with people and to encourage that kind of communication, the better. And actually, it's never too soon to develop a habit of trying to encourage the people around you to help you deliver safe care. You're always wanting to encourage people around you to speak up too, because actually, automatically, you're still the clinician, you're still the doctor, you are still, a lot of the time, we've just been speaking about you as at the bottom of the hierarchy, but actually at the same time, you're at the top of a different hierarchy. So actually, it's quite hard to realize that you're both, but that's where, of course, the flat hierarchy really helps.
Yeah. So we've gone through, I feel, a few things in this episode. If we're looking for...
Lessons learned. It's your turn. Yeah. Come on.
Summarise.
So, summarise. What have you learned?
So what have I learned from this conversation? So firstly, I think I've learned, and from the first time we spoke, I've stopped referring it to my epidural. Not their epidural, it's a epidural or a cesarean section. So that's something I've learned.
I think for me, I have definitely been guilty of using some of those suggestive terms. This is going to feel X. Do you think that adjusting that communication has been really, really valuable? And that repetitive, I hear you, I can see that you're uncomfortable, let's do something about it. That empowering conversation, I think that's just really, really valuable.
Yeah, and you probably see that in their faces.
Whilst we've gone through the blocks, as you've said, and making sure we're not suggesting other things, that you can if we're thinking about optimizing the environment, also do, when you're doing your consent, almost a mental rehearsal of what you're going to do, that, and so that if it happens in the 15% of cases and someone wants to get intraoperative pain, that we've got ways to encounter that, so it empowers them to speak up. The other thing, just to, I've gone slightly out of order, is almost rehearsing how you're going to check the block with them and that nothing will happen without them. And by saying nothing will happen without them, I think you're also putting that, trying to remove that time pressure that you felt of an obstetrician rubbing their hands together, ready to get started. No, nothing is happening without your say so, and stopping that pressure onto the mum, who would then feel that she needs to give more different answers than what she's feeling.
There's a lovely phrase that I know from a Swiss anaesthetist who I've worked with. He says, "Everyone is happy to wait for you."
That's quite nice.
It's like, yeah, we're all here for you, and we're happy to wait for you.
Oh, we're going to be seeing some of these phrases, I think.
Yeah. The good ones.
Yeah.
You know, we've got our glossary of terms. We should have a phrase book as well.
Maybe we'll put a phrase book onto the end of this, actually.
I just wanted to ask you a little bit that we haven't quite touched on about your follow-up. Was there any follow-up while you were in hospital? We've got a little separate episode on the follow-up visit, but I just wanted to ask your experience on that.
Nobody on the ward knew at all. So there was no support on the ward. And then I had an absolutely routine discharge note, which meant that when the community midwife came to visit me, I tried to say something, and her response was, you know, there was nothing in my notes. So she obviously thought I was probably making a fuss about nothing. She said, "Oh, never mind, dear. Baby's all right. That's all that matters." So you get shut down because you get told that your baby's all right. It's really, really hard to express the experience of trauma as a mother, because everybody says, "Baby's fine. You're so lucky." And so you can't, you know, you're just being shut down all the time. So I then actually went. It wasn't until he was 10 months old that I finally went to my GP and said, "I'm really struggling. I'm finding it very difficult to engage with life. I knew something was wrong." And to her immense credit, she looked me in the eye and said, "I completely believe you." But at that point, she went, like, "I should have known." And she pulled up my discharge note, and it was completely standard. And it didn't have anything about the general. It only said I'd had the regional. And I could see it on her screen, and I could see her slightly sort of scrolling up and down it with her looking at it. And she just said, not quite under her breath because I could hear it, she just said, "I should have known." And of course, had she known I'd had a general, that would have just been the tip off that something had been really stressful.
Yeah.
You know, that's just enough to give people a heads up. And that lack of follow-up meant that I was effectively let out into the community, having had this extraordinarily traumatic event, with absolutely no support. And that is something that I'm really passionate about, trying to make people aware that actually it makes an enormous difference. It's just ensuring that the next person in the system knows. That's all I'm saying. Because your influence over the care somebody receives does not finish when you personally stop seeing them. Your influence over the care they receive follows through in the notes, in the documentation, in, you know, a follow-up with the GP. Just give someone a heads up so that you don't have this situation where, because as much as anything else, you're putting them in the position of having to explain what happened, which is actually really difficult and can be quite triggering from people, particularly if they have the misfortune of speaking to someone who doesn't really get it.
And to summarise the 2022 follow-up, you are advised that an experienced clinician goes and speaks to the woman who has experienced pain during cesarean section, although as per the OAA, that every woman undergoing neuraxial technique should be followed up, or a GA. They should be aware of how to contact, or either a debrief or how to contact the anaesthetics department about it. And then there should be written communication to the GP before the 6-week mark of that baby checkup. Because again, having to re-go over your traumatic experiences, as we know from multiple studies, isn't good for the mother. And so having someone say, "I've read your notes, I understand," is way more powerful than someone having to almost sell their experience to
try and get believed. People.
Yes, exactly. Yeah,
to try to be believed. Yeah. And also to be aware, you know, in this country, at the 6-8 week check, you do a postnatal depression screening. The postnatal depression screening does not pick up factors that would be flagged by trauma.
No.
So.
Interesting, I didn't know that.
Yeah. I remember very clearly going down it, ticking the boxes, thinking, this isn't what's wrong. Because it's completely different. I wasn't depressed. No, wasn't depressed. I was suffering from PTSD. And so there was nothing that would flag it. Now, that may change with time, but for now, it emphasises why you really need to be on it.
Yeah.
And I think this is important as well if we think about encountering people for potential future operations, be it obstetric or non-obstetric. I had a recent experience where I went to, in a non-obstetric setting, I went to apply a BIS monitor to a patient while they were awake before we did the induction of anaesthesia, and they became very distressed and started crying. And it was only at that point, despite having been asked about issues with previous anaesthetics, they actually revealed that they had experienced awareness under a general anaesthetic previously. And so me just doing an action that I thought was best practice to put it on when they're awake, and a completely normal part of my normal anaesthetic to them was really, really triggering. And I guess when we're having conversations with people who are coming in, it's really important to know what happened during those previous experiences within the realms of what they're comfortable discussing and what they would like this time.
And don't forget that the trauma may not be anything to do with something that you can, that you would have any influence over. First point is to say, well, yes, trauma has a very, very long tail. It will stay with people. If people experience trauma during healthcare, it may influence their ability to access healthcare in the future, both for themselves and their children. They may be very reluctant to go in for a start. Just getting in as your patient, just being there, they will have been through this extraordinary process just to get themselves there. Poor us, absolutely on the edge anyway, yeah. Right? But as I say, trauma isn't just from healthcare. You know, many of your patients will have experienced trauma elsewhere. Like, you know, I've always been very aware that there are many women far more vulnerable than me, whether it's because they are girls too young, women who have been raped or abused or experienced other sorts of sexual violence, women who don't speak English, you know, minorities of all descriptions. You know, if it had almost broken me, well, what for them? And in many of these cases, people will not disclose.
Yeah.
They're not going to disclose. The statistics on rape and sexual abuse now are so high that I would almost say that you need to work on the basis that of treating everyone with the respect and compassion that you would if you knew. Because the chances are that in any day on your list, you might have one.
Yeah.
Which is really sobering about our whole society. But it's an important point to make, that people come with their experiences from before. It's so easy to see them as, you know, the patient today,
yeah,
but they've got their life before, and then you're influencing their life after.
And you can't reduce people, I guess, down to a guideline.
Well, the guideline stands as a really good place to start as a minimum standard.
But it's like,
but it's really hard, right, to deliver that level of care every day when you are under pressure, and yeah, I really understand that. We're asking a lot. The thing I would say, though, is that from people I speak to, most people will say, well, actually, when I'm delivering the best possible care, then usually you kind of feel the benefit of having done it. So how you respond to someone when something is difficult, afterwards you'll kind of go, right, okay, did a good job on that. And you'll know,
yeah,
you know, and that, yeah, is a better base. That's a better feeling to carry with you than not.
That's a very powerful lesson to come forward of, essentially the kindness and compassion element coming into it. I think we've gained a lot from this conversation, and I really hope it has been empowering for the novices who are listening to become the advocates for their patients, especially their psychological safety. Susanna, if you have any messages to our novices for the end of this episode, what would you like them to take away, or what messages would you like to give them?
So I think the first thing to say is, remember, it's an extraordinary privilege to be trusted by patients. Don't take that for granted. obviously, I would hope by the end of this, they're going to take pain seriously and that they understand the impact of trauma. Recognizing the long-term psychological impact of trauma means understanding that physical safety is the bare minimum of what should be expected. I often quote American obstetricians Emily Van Gompel and Elliot Main, who wrote, "Emotional and psychological trauma are safety errors, whether or not a patient leaves the hospital physically intact." And so for this purpose, it's all about being prepared. Please go read the OAA guidelines on prevention and management of pain. They're really about being prepared for failure. Paraphrasing Chris Furuck and Tim Cook's work on airway management, a plan suggests a single approach. A strategy is a coordinated, logical sequence of plans. Anaesthetists should approach with strategies rather than plans. The only true failure is failing to listen and to act. And just to finish, I think sometimes it's said about anaesthesia that you've done the job right if the patient doesn't remember you. Well, I disagree. A good neuraxial block makes an anaesthetist seem like a magician. That first time I had an epidural after 24 hours being in labor with my first son in 2008, and a very lovely trainee called Harry came and placed my epidural. And, you know, it was magic. Just remember that kindness and skill are what influence how you're going to be remembered.
Thank you so much. This has been a brilliant episode to record with you. We have learned so much from you. And yeah, I just wanted to say thank you for sharing your experience and all of your invaluable work on this. It's been a pleasure to host you.
Thank you very much.
Hello, and welcome to the outro. A huge, huge thank you goes to Susanna for a practice-changing conversation and coming forward and sharing her experience and the learnings from it and those from women who have undergone inadequate blockade during cesarean section. The links in bio I would strongly encourage to go and look at, including the must-reads Prevention and Management of Intraoperative Pain During Cesarean Section. We then have an article by Susanna about the genuine failure of neuraxial anaesthesia, followed by a piece from some anaesthetists in Adam Brooks, "You Test Because You Cannot Make Assumptions." Some topics that have come up in this episode obviously come with a degree of nuance, such as the waiting time before testing block. This varies depending on the situation that's in front of me in my practice. I would really recommend discussing it with the consultants in your department for what they advise. One of the other areas of nuance is in regards to the provision of a general anaesthetic. The guideline from the Prevention and Management of Intraoperative Pain states the anaesthetist should use their knowledge and expertise to decide when a GA should be offered and when it should be recommended. The woman, if possible, should be included in the discussion about how to proceed. NAP 8 also highlighted some challenges when it comes to general anaesthetics post-spinal. You should be thinking, is it safe? And what is the extra support I need to make it safe? Such as informing my consultant or getting a senior registrar or consultant there to help me with this general anaesthetic. I don't think the learnings for this episode would just be limited to novices, so please do share it with other anaesthetists who practice in obstetrics, as I think the learnings from this episode are so important.